You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Very happy to be welcoming Jeffrey today. Jeffrey's work tends to be in the area of all different aspects of the psychology of deception. And today he's going to be talking a lot about the changes that technology is bringing to how we deceive, are deceived, and perceive deception.
That's perfect. Exactly right. And I'm really, real pleasure to be here. A lot of my Cornell colleagues have been here, Sahar Byrne and Tarleton Gillespie. So it feels great to be part of this. And Judith is exactly right. Today I'm going to talk about the practices of deception mostly. I also do work on detection, but you had Professor Kasten here earlier, who covered, I thought, that very well. But if you are interested in it, I study how language is reflected, reflective of deception. And so if anybody's interested in the discussion, we can talk about that. But today I'm going to focus more on how we go about lying. There's a big asymmetry in the literature, actually. Most people are really interested in detecting deception, and much less is looked at how people go about doing it and why they might do it and things like that. So that's what we're going to focus on. And it's kind of easy to think about how deception takes place every day. Here's Tiger, perhaps the biggest scandal involving deception recently. He's back in golf and in the news as well. And this is just one of many scandals that comes up. It seems like there's almost every week there's a new scandal, political, business, etc., that involves deception. And it's very easy for people to think, and often do think, that deception is becoming more and more common. This is perhaps the most important myth that I'd like to address today, one of several we'll go over. And the reason I think this is a myth isn't because I have hard data, but because you can look throughout history, and almost every generation thinks the previous generation was more honest, more noble. And if that's the case, then it seems like perhaps the idea that deception is occurring more now is problematic. Here's a good example of somebody that thought his current generation was very deceptive. Does anybody know what Diogenes was looking for with his lantern? Yes, one honest man. And did he find him? No, Diogenes died without finding a single honest man. So the Greeks were aware of deception and the important role it played in human life. And I think that this is an indicator that deception is a very ancient sort of human behavior. It's not just human, of course, but something to focus on today, and quite pervasive. And I think what I want to get across today is how the reasons that we go about lying or not lying are very old. And technology will play some roles here, but the motivations and the constraints we're going to talk about are perhaps much stronger than technology itself. And this is where we think about technology. Technology is now a huge part of our lives. We can call it ubiquitous. Every other week, again, there's another story about how more and more people are using more and more social media or computers or technology or software to do almost any aspect of human life. And this is really what the talk's going to be about, is when these two things, a pervasive social activity and a ubiquitous technology, come together, it allows us to sort of think about what do we assume about deception, what do we assume about technology. And some easy assumptions come to mind, for instance, that technology can help us lie. Here's a great example, one of my favorites. This is an actual company in Chicago called Alibi Network, and they provide essentially deception services for people for a price. And if I wanted Judith to think that I was actually in New York today, I could leave a number with her that I'd purchased from them. And when Judith called the number, one of the operators at Alibi Network would answer and say, "Hello, Hilton, New York." And Judith would say, "Could I have Jeff Hancock's room?" And they would say, "Certainly," and patch her through to wherever I was. And so she would believe that I was at the Hilton in New York. So technology can easily facilitate deception. There's many, many examples. But it's not so straight. Oh, did you have a question? No. And please jump in with questions anytime. Anytime. It's not straightforward, though. There's other instances we can think of pretty quickly, too, where technology kind of leads to super honesty or super disclosure. Here's one off of Post Secret, which is a blog that takes postcards anonymously sent to them, and they post them every Sunday. It's actually a guy that does this. This particular one says, "After I was date raped, I dated and slept with the guy that did it three more times. I hope that if I could make it a real relationship, I wouldn't have to admit to myself that the rape was real. And this is one of the kind of confessions that you would only say maybe to your closest family or to a therapist or close friends. And Post Secret has at least 2 million people looking at it a week. So we can see technology playing this role to facilitate deception, but also seems to facilitate really intense honesty. And so what I want to do is sort of...
That's assuming that that's real.
That's absolutely right. That could be a fake confession, yes. And that's one of the things we'll go about into today, is where technology can bring some new things to deception, but in many other ways, we have this very old deception these old deception patterns or habits that are difficult to break. And when I say that these habits are difficult to break, on the one side, the motivations to lie and how often we lie, which is pretty frequent, stay in place. So we will continue to lie as technology flourishes. But we also have a lot of habits about not lying. So there are lots of times when I could lie to somebody for gain, either internal, like something to do with my self-esteem perhaps, or for external, like to avoid punishment or get some money, that I don't end up lying. Any kind of honor system is one, but also in our day-to-day interactions, why don't we just lie to people all the time? Well, there are internal constraints, like I don't want to be to consider myself a liar. And there's external constraints, like I don't want other people to think of me as a liar. And we'll see that these things, these two habits about that push lying but also constrain it, are going to stay with us. And we'll see how they sort of maintain themselves through communication that involves technology. And I should be a good scholar and define how I think about deception. I think a deception is this larger category, and when I use lying, I mean it pretty much the same way, except lying is what we humans do. It's verbal, message-based. And to me, deception has essentially two main components to it. It's intentional, misleading. So if I'm trying to create a false belief in another person, and I do that intentionally. If Judith told me to show up at 1 today, when I was supposed to be here at 12, then that would be a lie if she was intentionally doing that. If she thought that I was supposed to be here at 1, that'd be a mistake. Okay? And I study mediated communication. So anything from, you know, video communication to text-based messaging to cell phone conversations. Let's take a look first at self-presentations. Almost all of us have to do some kind of self-presentation online now. How many of you have one kind of profile online, like a Facebook profile or a website? How many of you have at least two sites where you have to present yourself? How about three? More than five? Yeah, right? After a while, it's like, yeah, I've got about 4 or 5 pages. So we all now have to think about not only how we get dressed in the morning, what jacket to wear, but what do we look like online? So here's the president. He has a Facebook profile. I have a number of profiles. I have one on LinkedIn, which is a place where I can talk about my professional links and status. Facebook, of course, is the other big, large one. And then there's another one that's important for relationships. That's online dating, a very important social activity now. Over 17 million Americans are engaged regularly in online dating. And you can see there's lots of places here where there's choices that this woman has had to make decisions about what she's going to represent herself as to the world. She can say anything she wants here. There are no constraints on what she can say, at least technologically. She could say she was 36 years old. She could say she was 20 years old. Because we don't know. She's not here in the room with us. So one thing we wanted to do is look at what do people say in this virtual space and compare that to what they actually are in the physical space. And we can think about how sort of our goals to engage in self-presentation might affect lying. So let's just lay out the goals here quickly. First of all, you want to appear attractive. That's the kind of point of online dating. You want to be as attractive as possible to get a potential mate. And you might use different things, like I can choose what photo I want to use. I can take my time to craft it. I can edit it once I've written it to make it appear better. I need to also appear honest, however. If I do create a completely fake profile and then I meet the woman for lunch, it's not going to go any further than that because I'm a liar, right? So I need to also appear honest when I'm creating this self-presentation. And men and women have different self-presentation goals because men and women typically, on average, value other specific things in each other. So men tend to prefer slender, younger women, and women tend to prefer more powerful, dominant, and physically taller men. And there's been a lot of work on this. We can talk about that as well if you'd like, but evolutionary psychologists have documented this a number of times. So we can think about the deception strategy. What do you guys think would be a good deception strategy if your self-presentation goal was just to appear attractive? What should you do lying-wise?
Who views definitely younger looking.
Younger photos?
Years, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hair dye.
Hair dye, yeah, sure.
Photoshop
would be another good one, yeah. Yeah, and we do see evidence of all those things. But essentially what you're saying is you should lie, right? If you want to appear attractive, then you should take advantage of the ability to lie frequently, dye your hair, use a younger photo. and we do in fact see, for example, that women use photos that were taken earlier in their life. They tend to be about 17 months younger of versions of themselves, whereas men are about seven months younger. So yes, we should lie frequently, but this is going to interact with our appear honest goal. So now what should our lying strategy be?
Don't lie too much.
Don't lie too much. Perfect. Lie subtly. You need to lie a little bit. You want to take advantage of this space to appear attractive, but you still need to appear honest. And then if we have these gendered goals, then if females know what men want, then they should lie about their weight and age. And men, if they know what women want, should lie about, for example, their height. And also how much money they make and what their economic status is and educational status and things like that. But we had difficulty measuring that. So I'll show you how we ended up measuring these specific things. We took the profile that a person had and we brought them into the lab and we actually measured by putting them on a scale their weight, and we put them up against the wall and got their height, and we got their age from their driver's license, and we took photos of them and got their income tax form to get their income. But a lot of them lied to us about their social security number, so we actually couldn't get their tax form, which is kind of brilliant, right? Deception for protection. And so we call this a cross-validation approach. So rather than having to rely on did you lie or not, or telling people to lie for us, we actually are looking at the differences between what they said virtually and physically. And so let me just walk you through some of the findings. And the reason I'm going into such detail for this study is it really gets at this idea of how our old motivations and constraints, these really ancient psychological influences, still play out in this very new communication space. So this axis here is how tall the person said they were online. And this axis here is how tall they were when we observed them in the lab. Okay, we put them up against the wall. And this line here represents sort of the truth line. If your dot lies on that line, then you are exactly the height that you said you were. These are women. And you can see women are sort of scattered around the line. There isn't a clear pattern. This woman here, for example, is saying that she's 3 inches taller than she actually was. Okay, and we had two of those, and then the rest were sort of around this line. Now for men, it's a much different story. You can see that there's a bias here, right? All of the men, almost every one of them, are lying by saying that they're taller than they actually are. It was about 9/10 of an inch on average, or what I call strong rounding up. So if you get to 5'9 and 1/10 of an inch, 5'10. And so you can see that all of these dots here are men saying that they're taller than they actually are. And this is very consistent with what the strategy should be if they want to take advantage of the communication space. And it's not random. It's not like they just don't know how tall they are and they made an error. We also asked them how deceptive their height was when they said that, and our findings here correlate with what they said. So they knew that they were being deceptive about these things. Yeah?
What's the margin of error of height estimation?
It tends to be about half an inch. Usually people know within an inch of where they're at.
Sorry, someone else, if I see you.
That's a really good question. I don't know the answer to that. I bet you it's within this, they're operating within that error of margin. That's exactly what we think, yeah.
What's the resolution of reporting? Because if you can't say that you're 5'4 and a half, you're going to say you're 5'5.
Right. I believe the resolution was to the inch. So you're right, that you would expect people, if they were 5'9 and half an inch to report maybe 5'10" and round up. But that's not the case.
So I wouldn't call that deception. I'd call that, you know.
Well, they did. The actual participants themselves, when we asked them,
they said this is lying.
They said they were lying. And you can see here that the women who faced the same resolution issue are scattered around the truth line, whereas this is clearly systematic. Yeah. Now let's take a look at weight. And this time, the women show sort of a distinct pattern. This is how much they said they weighed, and here's how much they actually weighed. And you can see that all the women are sort of clumping above the line. So they're saying they're lighter than they actually are in real life. And as they get heavier, the sort of discrepancy between the truth line and what they said gets bigger. So heavier women are saying that they're lying more. And so this is very consistent. It was about, on average, 8 or 9 pounds was the difference.
You have an outlier here.
Oh, yes. Yes. Yeah. Here. And then this one here is also quite large. I think this is, I can't remember exactly how much that was, but it's in the high 20 range pounds. Now, the men are a little bit different. Their sort of pattern shifts up so that these guys up here are acting like the women, in that the heavy, heavy guys are saying that they're lighter than they actually are. But you can see some very light guys down here are actually saying they're heavier. So this is kind of classic regression to the mean. You know, little dude wants to be a little bit bigger, big dude wants to be a little bit smaller. And then we were looking at age. We expected women to lie more about their age. We didn't see any significant sort of differences between men and women on age. In fact, we saw very little lying about age. Again, an outlier here. This is 10 years. This is 10 years as well. But most people are right on that line. And you guys have any thoughts as to why, whereas with height and weight, there was a lot of movement around the line, why age is bang on? Match didn't verify it at the time. They may do so now. I don't think they do. Right. It's a verifiable thing, right? So you are your age, especially in our society anyways. And so it's documentable. It's verifiable. And one of the things that came out of the interviews with the women in particular is you can't do much with your age. Whereas with weight, for example, some women would say that they would say that weight because if they got a date, they would use that as a dieting incentive to get down to that weight. And with height, you can put heels on and shoes and things like that to make yourself look taller, whereas your age is your age. And deceptions about age are a little bit more serious, I think, than deception of those other things. They're kind of like deal breakers. So we can see, though, that those very, very old psychological influences, motivations, whatever you want to call them, are in place, but it's not like people just started lying willy-nilly. You're a bunch of Brad Pitts and Angelina Jolie's dating there. They're all quite close. Most of the lies tended to be within 5% of their actual numeric height or weight or age. So we saw a lot of lying, but that word "a lot" sort of confounds magnitude and frequency. Yes, people lied frequently, but the lies tended to be not very large at all. Okay. We can see this not only in the world of love, but also in the world of work. This is a LinkedIn profile of the PhD student I did this next project with. We wanted to look at lying in resumes. And resumes are going online much more frequently now. And what we wanted to do was compare deceptions in, say, a paper-based traditional resume and an online resume. And our, a first thought is that, well, maybe online, because people can say whatever they want, you should see more deceptions. Indeed, when we ask people this, just poll them, more people tend to think that more lies will occur on LinkedIn than in a paper-based resume. And we're not sure exactly what that bias is, other than I think there's a tendency, this myth, to think that things online are more likely to be deceptive. So what we did is we created a scenario for our undergraduates that they had to create a resume for a job, a very attractive job that many of them would want, and the best applicants would actually receive money for doing this. And there were essentially two conditions. One, that we did it as a paper base, so they filled it on a word processor, printed out, and gave it to the researcher, or they filled it out on LinkedIn. All the information was exactly the same, except in the LinkedIn condition, it was going to be public. They actually did it on LinkedIn, and they had to give us some names of people that we could link their profile to. Okay. Now, do you guys have any thoughts about how the lies might differ across, say, a paper-based one that you hand into a boss versus one that you post up on the internet?
Well,
LinkedIn would be more honest, I would guess.
More honest on
LinkedIn.
On LinkedIn, yeah.
Easier to get caught.
Exactly. So this is what we were thinking. And Judith and Dana Boyd in 2004 did a really nice thought piece predicting exactly this, that when your network is able to examine statements and claims that you make, there's a number of incentives for you to be more honest. And a basic one is you don't want your network, the most important people to you, to think that you're deceptive. Well, we actually didn't find any numeric differences in the lies. There were three lies in each type on average. So paper-based resumes had about three lies each on average, and so did LinkedIn. But they changed the kinds of lies. We went through and analyzed the kinds of lies. And the way it works is they fill out the resume, and then afterwards they say, okay, great job. Now can you go through and just show us where you've exaggerated and tell us what more truthful thing would be? And we found that the paper-based lies, much more important deceptions took place. Lies about what their responsibilities were in previous jobs and their involvement in different types of projects and things at their old job. These are things that are central to the job that you're going to be hiring them for. In the LinkedIn one, where they knew their profile was public and that their network would have access to it, they lied about much different things. They were less important and, I think, critically, sort of less verifiable. They lied about what their interests were. And guess what? Who knows what your interests are? You do. Everybody else can guess. They can say whatever they want, but you get to say what your interests are. And hobbies. Hobbies are similar. They're a little bit more overt, but we found a lot more of the lies tended to be about interests and hobbies here. Now, if I'm an employer, I'd want to be looking at these resumes because I don't really care that much about interests and hobbies. But I'm going to care a lot more, I think, about responsibilities and involvement.
Yeah. This has to do with the free-form nature of making it in a document. So they made it in the document form. Could they have not even listed any hobbies or interests? I mean, because when you're filling in a LinkedIn profile, it nags you to fill in all these boxes.
We basically
write about hobbies.
Yeah, no, I hear you. We took the LinkedIn categories and we made them write about them in the free-form document. Yeah, so they had to fill in the exact same categories. They're essentially those four are the main types of information LinkedIn asks for.
Question: when you asked them to have someone they could be linked to, was it primarily their other undergraduate friends that linked to you?
Well, that was a problem. We hadn't been thinking about social networks well enough, and so we let them do whoever they wanted. And so we don't have a good sense of the kind of people that were doing it. But you're right. If it was bosses and things, that would imply a different kind of, say, surveillance than if it was just their friends. I think it may have been friends, because why else would you even lie about this? I think that the lying here is because I want to look interesting to my social network, but I don't want to lie here.
The paper ones are more for an employer,
right?
So you always lie for your audience. So they're lying
That's right.
for the employer audience, and they're lying for the social
for the
audience.
Social network. And so I think you're exactly right. You're shaping the audience, which then shapes the kind of constraints that are on your deception motivation. So I want to lie. I want to be as attractive as an employee as possible. But the audience constrains you in different ways about how you go about using deception as a resource to do that.
Sometimes there's also, you can interpret a word all kinds of ways without it per se being lying.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody looking at it, and I'm thinking of something in particular, and do I feel like sharing it? I'm not sure. But I think like a client can be pro bono or not,
uh-huh.
Somebody might look at that and say, that wasn't her client.
That's right.
But you know, I've gotten into some wordplay around some folks with that. And
yeah.
So it depends on how you define that. And you could say, well, it depends on how you define that.
It's true.
And that's a gray area.
It is a gray area. And there's a lot about deception that when you first start thinking about it, you can come out with these sort of strong conclusions. But there are a few rabbit holes around deception that you can go down very quickly. In this case, we gave them our deception definition, so intentional and misleading, creating a false belief, and they were the ones that identified the lies, not us in this case. We defined what kind of lie they were, but not whether they were deceptive or not.
How do you know if they were lying about what they were lying about?
This is a big question, the meta-lying problem, and it comes up in a lot of our studies. And it's actually one of the main reasons...
Somebody's a habitual liar, they're going to...
That's right. One of the main reasons we did that online dating study is because then I didn't have to rely on them. We could look at the actual differences. But in a way, it doesn't really matter because I think we can look across patterns. We're not interested in, say, exactly how many lies people do. It's the patterns that are involved rather than, say, absolute frequency. Yep.
Is it possible
possibly something around the fact that with the LinkedIn bio, and I'm seeing it apart from technology, when something is social, we want people to think that we're more fun than we maybe are, right? Everybody says that they're into cooking,
that's
and
right.
yoga, and running,
and reading books, and hiking. Everyone hikes.
Everybody hikes, everybody yeah. does yoga.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So what role does the technology necessarily play?
Well, technology forces us to have to make claims about that. So it says, hey, what book are you reading, as an example? Whereas before, we didn't have to walk around with stuff on us saying what our last favorite book was.
Right, but I mean, if you did this same comparing the mm-hmm. two, and one was, if instead of social media technology, you said put your CV on a bulletin board, a hard copy CV on a bulletin board.
Mm-hmm. I think you'd see started this some of the very same...
Right.
shaping. Yeah, I think you would see different kinds of laws, if it's made public especially.
Right, so the social and the technology can actually be separate.
Yes,
right.
I agree.
No, the
I agree.
Technology is paper in that case.
Right.
Yeah, and there's
right.
paper as the technology.
Right.
That's right.
Which,
yes?
Are there any distinction between the people don't say online? I mean, it just because, for example, it was employed by some company but not mm-hmm. not present online, but mm-hmm. is, have you compared this kind of a not hiding kind of deception?
So is it like lies of omission, where you don't say something?
Yeah, I don't say something, mm-hmm. but I just don't say it. Perhaps I was in prison.
Yeah.
I didn't say
yeah,
it.
Yeah, but you don't note that. Absolutely. That it wouldn't get caught in our procedure here. And lies of omission are the most difficult for us to research. Yeah. Yes. And they're probably one of the most effective forms of lying. Yeah, they don't leave a record.
Can you briefly talk a bit about how on the match study you were able to select the people that came in for mm-hmm. verification?
Mm-hmm. So this is probably the biggest limitation of that study. We tried to do it in Ithaca for about a month, and not one person responded. They're either students or tending sheep, I guess. I don't know. And so we went to New York, and a colleague of mine, Michael Schober at the New School, allowed us to use his lab. And we put it into Craigslist and Village Voice. And a little over 400 people signed up for the study. They had a couple criteria, so they had to be an active online dater. And we were interested in heterosexuals in this study, so we limited it to heterosexuals. And they got paid $30 to talk about self-presentation and online dating, so there's no mention of deception. But it would attract people that were on the lower end of the income spectrum, so it wasn't at all a sort of stratified sample. When we look at it, in fact, it's definitely biased towards younger, poorer people when we look at, say, Andrew Fiore's analysis of a national dating sample. Yep.
Do you think your lack of response to Ithaca might have been the fact that it's a fairly small, closed-in, isolated community where a lot of people know each other and don't want to do anything that could interfere with their social relationships like this?
I think so. And, you know, the data was actually collected probably about 4 years ago, so online dating hadn't evolved to a place where there are lots of small little niche ones that people can go on where you're not going to run into people that you know. But it's a very small town with a very small non-student population, so I think that's why. That's okay for the sample?
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to skip through that. So, old habits, die hard. We looked at two sort of self-presentation formats, love, work. And in both cases, we saw that the motivation to look good leads to some lying, but that there are some serious constraints that can take place there. In one, it was the audience that was going to be there, whether it was your social network or only an employer. In the other, it was potential dates. Right? And we think that there are still these constraints. Now, we look primarily at external things, external constraints, but Dan Ariely and his colleagues have looked at some internal constraints. So he finds when he lets people cheat in a paradigm where they can get away with cheating by taking all of the money from a jar, most people only take about 20 to 30%. And his argument is that there's some internal constraints on cheating or lying, in that we don't want to be considered deceptive ourselves. We don't want to have a self-identity as a liar. And so this is another area that we're starting to look at to see how technology can work on that kind of constraint. Now, there are a couple ways, I think, that technology do bring some new things to deception. So it's not just that, you know, deception's not going to change at all. It's exactly the same. I do think there are some new ways. So here's a classic, what we're going to call Butler lie. On my way. when in fact you haven't left the house yet or you haven't left the office yet. And most people have either sent one of these or received one. And we call them butler lies because back in the day, we would have butlers that sort of acted as a social buffer. Somebody would come to my house and they would, you know, present themselves to the butler, and the butler would check with me, do I want to see them or not, and then make up some excuse. For example, Master Hancock is not available at the moment, or something like that. Well, now we're more available to people than we ever have been before, and we don't typically have butlers. And so we argue that these little lies that we tell to each other function to act as a social buffering mechanism, but more importantly, to manage our relationships so that we stay true to our relationship. We want to remain friends and know that I value you, while at the same time creating space to not interact or allow reasons for why I'm not going to be able to interact with you when you want to. So we can take a look at these sort of things, and basically they're made possible, the butler essentially is possible because of ambiguities that are introduced by technology. And so one ambiguity is temporal. When I get an SMS message, the other person doesn't know when I got that message. Okay, so we see these kinds of butler lies. Sorry, I just saw your text. Now, the way we go about collecting this kind of data is we have students pull out their phone and go to their outbox and basically go through the last 30 messages that they sent. And they have to identify each time that they lied. Okay, and we find that about 10% of both SMS messages and IM messages for students are deceptive. And that within that, around 20% of those lies are these butler lies. But that's how we go about getting there. So again, it's self-reported. They tell us when they're lying, and then we code for whether they're something to do with temporal ambiguity. In this case, sorry, I just saw your text. An excuse about why I didn't respond to somebody, and I'm taking advantage of the ambiguity that you don't know when I received that message. Another type of ambiguity is about what I'm actually doing. So I can't lie to you guys about what I'm doing right now or who I'm with, because I'm physically in the room with you. But if we were talking by the telephone, we certainly could. This is a whole new area of ambiguity. This is sort of a nasty butler lie, I think. Hey, sorry, I can't talk. I have a really bad migraine in bed. And that was to somebody's parents. The person just wanted to talk and hang out with friends and not talk to parents. And in SMS, so with telephone messaging, this was the majority of the butler lies. Almost, you know, 80, a little over 80%. And lastly, there's location ambiguity. Again, I can't lie to you about where I am because I'm with you, but when you're on a telephone, say, as opposed to IM, you don't know where they are. So people often will say things like this, I'm almost there. Now in this case, the LOL, I don't know, that could be like, I'm almost there, and you know, like I'm lying to you, which raises some questions about whether that's a lie or not, but this person reported it being a lie. So this is work with Jeremy Bernholtz, and I think it really points out a nice thing where we still have these old ancient motivations to make our relationship seem good, to not come across like just a late jerk or somebody that doesn't want to talk to other people. But it's providing some new resources for us to use deception to maintain our relationships and our self-presentation, namely these kinds of ambiguities. And that social technical point that you made earlier is really clear in this data. And I don't mean to put a bunch of numbers up here, but this is SMS, so this is with a telephone messaging. And this is with instant messaging using the same basic procedure. Go through your last messages and tell us when you were lying. But what we see is in instant messaging, we see a lot more lying about exiting and a lot less about arranging. And it's because of the social aspects of what these two technologies are used for. SMS is typically used to arrange other social interactions, whereas instant messaging is about having ongoing conversations. And probably the biggest design flaw with IM that comes out the interviews that Jeremy Bernholtz does with people is, I don't know how to get out of an instant messaging conversation. Like, how do you leave IM? And so people just often lie. I have to go. I have work. I need to go eat, going to sleep. But really, they just want to talk with somebody else. And that's also a synchronicity issue. So I think it's both the social, which would be the why they're using these things, and the synchronicity issue, which is a technical issue. So we think social technical factors lead to these kind of ambiguities that can shape, once again, how we go about lying.
This is a delightful tie-in to the privacy and a great response to the if you don't have anything to hide response, which is that we need this space to hide behind for social ambiguity.
That's right. And a lot of this work that we've done was inspired by a paper by Aoki and Woodruff in Chi, I think, 2005. And the title was just fantastic. It was basically Making Space for Stories. And they had this idea that came out of some of Bill Gaver's work that, you know, ambiguity is this important resource for people. But a lot of designers have this idea that we want to create more clear communication, more accurate, right? And Kirsten Boehner and I did a philosophical sort of rejoinder to that, which is it's not clear that you could ever have a completely unambiguous communication, even if you were able to hook brains up. And so if people are interested in that, we can talk about that some more. Yes?
Yeah, I was wondering how much you get into, in your own effort, you know, at this, the social network research that mm-hmm. is, you know, divorced of technology, and it's really just focused on how do people maintain their relationships
yeah.
or end them. They're constantly in negotiation and so on. You know, you mentioned the butler, but, you know, that's a very, very rarefied mm-hmm. case. Mm-hmm. People are, everybody every day is always negotiating every single social relationship. So it'd be interesting to see how much this actually deviates mm-hmm. because we do turn people off and we say, well, I'm sorry, you're in the grocery store and I got to run, you know.
Right.
But if you really wanted to talk to that person, you'd stand there for
you'd
another
make
10
the,
minutes.
Make so. The time for them. I agree with you 100% about the negotiation aspect, and we're moving more into the relational work. So my background as a psychologist makes me think about self-presentation and about language. And so we're only talking about the self-presentation. But you're absolutely right. And I think of deception as this resource. And in negotiation, deception is one resource. But it's a very specific kind, and it can be potentially hazardous, too. Yeah.
And here I think it's useful also to separate what potential harm there is to the recipient, because mm-hmm. I think there's a big difference between deceptions that are either meant to cause harm or do cause harm. And a lot of these that fall into the realm of politeness are
right.
really about face saving.
Right.
So that, you know, I don't know how to end the conversation. You know, like if I was giving you the unvarnished truth, it was like, you know, I'm getting kind of bored talking to you. But it's a really hurtful thing to say. You have no desire
yeah.
to hurt this person. They may be just as bored with you. So you do something face saving. So these are lies that are, to a large extent, meant to be beneficial.
That's right.
And it's a useful distinction to make. And
I think so too. And a lot of my work focuses on the interpersonal sort of parts of our lives. And a lot of times with talks, I'll start off by saying, you know, we all know there are spammers and scammers and people that are out for nefarious ends. And this part of the work is not about those folks. And I think for the majority of lies that are told to the majority of people, we lie for a reason. It's typically self-presentation related, face-saving related, the vast majority of the lies. And there's only some of those that are about, you know, lying about, you know, what your education was to get a better job. And you know, I met with somebody that worked at Fidelity for quite some time, and his job was to track down and verify resume claims. And he said it was shocking, you know, that almost every resume had an exaggeration, but the number that had an outright lie were pretty incredible. So yes, I think that's important to note. We're looking really a lot here at politeness lies. One last thing that I'd like to introduce is the idea of the digital trace, which people here at Berkman have thought about a lot. And I'm just going to tell you about a tiny little study that I think highlights probably the most important single thing that technology will do for deception. We had people record in PDAs all of their social interactions for 7 days, and then also record their lies. So if I was talking to Judith afterwards, I'd pull out my PDA and I'd be like, I just talked to Judith and I was on the phone and I lied. And we would take that data and try to look at how often people were talking in different media, face-to-face, phone, email, instant messaging, and then also how many of the social interactions in that medium contained a lie. Because we still tend to talk mostly face-to-face, although that's changing. And so we wanted to take a look at that. And what we found was this pattern. And we've replicated this a number of times, as have other groups here in the U.S. and in the U.K., is that the telephone typically involves the most lies when you use this diary method. The telephone is very sort of deceptive. And yes, that number seems very high. this number, 37%, isn't super important. It's the relative patterns. But the reason it's so high is we're following a method devised by Bella DiPaolo in 96. And in that, it was only in what she called serious conversations or important conversations. They had to be 10 minutes or longer. So if you talk, according to these data, very similar to other data, to somebody for more than 10 minutes, the chance that you'll encounter a lie, either that you provide or they do, is quite high. But the more important thing is the relative weights. We've found quite frequently that email tends to be the place where people lie the least. And the interesting thing that started to occur was even when we asked people where they thought they lied the most, the people that were recording the data, they would say, oh, email or maybe instant messaging. But when we looked at their data, where they recorded things after every single time, they lied less than email. This particular data was pre-SMS. I mean, it was happening, but it wasn't a big deal in the US yet. So this is 2004, 2003. But we would put it probably closer to instant messaging. Yep.
What's the proportion of serious phone calls?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
I mean, when you ask them where they thought they were lying the most, did you make that
decision? It was at the end after they had done all this data collection. So yeah, they would have known. Yeah.
It's just it's hard to imagine a really long or complicated email and instant message, but I'm just wondering how likely it is just related to the length of the conversation.
Yes, we think that this procedure, and again, we've replicated with other kind of instructions getting rid of this sort of 10-minute thing. This would work against email because you would typically have fewer emails that were long, right? And yet so that would make a small denominator, which should... It was emails that took about 10 minutes or more to construct in this particular study. That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes?
People lie less than email because email tends to stay around. I mean, you know, a phone call is usually not recorded. Instant messages could be kept, but usually aren't. Emails tend to be archived.
Precisely right. I think that the most important thing, and what's interesting, is that these people seem to be a little bit aware of this unconsciously, because when we asked them, they thought, oh, I lied most in email. But the most important thing about deception is whether it's recorded or not, right? And if you think of all those scandals I was talking about at the beginning of politicians, businessmen, Tiger Woods, it's all because something was recorded digitally. And I think that the digital world is transforming the way our conversations, our behaviors are traced, essentially. So this is a New York Times article, and in this, divorce lawyers report that over half of all of their divorce cases, the primary form of evidence is email or text messaging. And it's because it's very, very difficult to get rid of anything you do digitally. I mean, you have the Internet Archive downloading the unpassword protected internet on a regular basis. You have Google caching things within minutes on things that they own and within a couple hours on things that they don't. It's an interesting exercise. If you put something on a blog and then see how long it takes Google to cache it, it's sort of shocking. So everything that we put online is traceable, and not only is it traceable in this era of Google, it's searchable. And so what's, I think, a little frightening and fascinating is imagine 20 years down the road where all of this information is still recorded and out there, but our algorithms for searching will become, you know, vastly more powerful. So those are two things, I think, where there's some important changes in the way deception, the way technology can change deception. Ambiguity introduces these new sources of deception possibilities, and technology, especially digital ones, create really, I don't want to say permanent, but it's right up there, traces of our behaviors. Yes?
It's so perplexing, all of this, to me, and I'm just thinking of an example of someone that got in touch with me a year later via text. And I didn't even know who it was because I didn't have their number that comes up with their name.
Right.
So it was eerie getting it in the middle of the night. Who are you? I felt like he knew where I lived. I felt very stalked. It was yucky. And then I called in the morning and just say, who is this? And it didn't leave the name. And then he texted me a little bit more information, and then I said, I'm sorry, I don't remember, and then he reminded me of a particular moment, and I'm like, aha. But when I called and I got him on the phone, he was here locally for a moment, he didn't want to talk. He wanted to connect, but he didn't want to talk. It was safer for him to somehow connect. And I just find like it's psychologically so confusing how you deal with these very strange ways of communicating. And there's a whole other psychology.
Yeah. Well, this
connected to these, and it's also professional because people can dish you, or they just are so having 250 emails, but they don't really. So they can say they're really swamped as an excuse for, or it could be very real. It leaves a whole other, and it's only going to get worse. So I don't know how it's going to.
Yeah. Well, we've been living for millennia without the ability to be instantly kept in touch, without everything we do or say being recorded. And it's only been a couple of decades that we're starting to get used to this. So I think confusion is exactly the right word. And I was talking with Dana when I was visiting last time, that it's not that privacy and our sense of identity and things are no longer that important to us, as is sometimes sort of assumed. It's that I think we're really grappling with these insanely rapid changes relative to our history. We've been speaking to each other for about 60,000 years, and it's only been, you know, even a couple of, you know, maybe four centuries that things have been recorded that have been said in a way, right? So I think there's a big confusion issues.
Is there a reaction? Are there empirical studies on reactions to lies and how those have changed over time?
There are some, and we're just moving into that space. We want to see how people respond to Butler lies. Do they appreciate them? Does it bug them? That kind of thing. And we're just starting those now. But there was a really nice study came out 2 years ago that I think speaks to this. So it was looking at Chinese and Americans' judgments about types of deceptions. And Chinese, for example, found that deceptions like the ones we're talking about now, where it's about face saving, were quite acceptable and considered, you know, fine. Whereas Americans were much more like, no, that's deceptive, that's wrong. So far, the early data suggests that there's no difference in how often people do it. It's just the attitudes are a little different about that. So I think that the perceptual aspect is very important. And we're just moving into that direction now. Yeah.
Kind of forecasting as to how this will evolve and how there aren't laws per se that can connect to this, but in terms of more protocols or value-driven something or other. Is anybody doing any kind of research or forecasting with any of that?
Yeah, I'm not sure about the forecasting side. It's such a dangerous business. But I enjoy speculating about it, and I do think that there are some legal connections. So there was a firm called TrueData, I believe it was called, in Michigan that tried to have the state pass law that there had to be identity verification for online dating. So they tried to bring the legal framework in, and they, of course, had identity certification services ready to go. So there was a legal economic connection there. But yeah, so I think, I can't think of a single person that I would say, oh, this is a good forecaster of this, but.
I think. Grappling, and so I'm thinking, you know, are we going to move to a less grappling?
Yeah, I think that I think that our children who are growing up in this environment are going to be much less confused. In the same way that we could be considered like pigeon speakers, we're coming to this new language of living online as adults, and so we have a very restricted vocab. Our children are going to be exposed to this and speak Creole, which is a much more sophisticated, fully fledged language.
Except I think you're forgetting that the technology is changing rapidly, so they may be much better at dealing with things like Facebook and LinkedIn and what will seem like very antique technologies, but they're going to be living in a world of, for instance, much more pervasive physical surveillance. They'll be dealing with a lot of biosensors and things that we're just, I mean, there's science fiction thinking about those. Right. So, you know, you said you'd talk later about, you know, do you ever want, you know, complete brain honesty? But either live in a world where a lot more of the our understanding of brain patterns will be different. So, you know, I think the types of privacy issues and lying issues that we're dealing now will seem very quaint when our children are in their 40s.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be much, much different and difficult to anticipate.
I don't think it'll be less confusing.
Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Phones were in walls and there was no such thing as caller ID. Do you think that, you know, the move to cell phones and the, you know, almost ubiquitous caller ID has changed the nature of of lying, and is that anything that you did in your study?
We didn't look at that in the study per se. I think, yes, it does. It definitely changes the patterns. There's, forgetting his name, but talks about caller hegemony. And people like Lee Humphreys have looked at this. So before, the caller had all the power because they got to interrupt you and, you know, didn't know who they were. And that is shifting a little bit. So now at least I can make some judgments based on your identity. We are doing a new study on something called BBM, which is the BlackBerry messaging service. It's very similar to text messaging. There's one difference. We exchange pins, and that means that once you receive my text message, I know that. Right? So that temporal ambiguity goes away. And what we're expecting is that we should see very few, if any, lies that rely on that temporal ambiguity. So I send you a BBM, and then as soon as you open that, I know, the service lets me know that you've already opened up that message. Yep, that's right.
And that's sort of why the term receipts for email have never made a whole lot of sense, because just because it's in my inbox doesn't mean that I actually read what was there.
That's right. And I think that's one of those pushes towards more clear communication, that I think ambiguity will continue. It just changes shape in a way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So sort of a question about your methodological approaches, which is sort of interesting that you're able to study a lot of these sort of face-saving lies and this sort of thing, but you're kind of necessarily having to study these because these are the types of lies where self-reporting is, you know, something likely to be honest and
right.
will work. Have you thought or done any work in the area of trying to study bigger lies, and is that just too hard and not at this point?
No, or? It's definitely an area we're working on, and I'll tell you about one study. I have some slides, but I'll just tell you, and if we need them, then you know. So, taking this trace idea a little further, we're trying to use a little bit of history in order to identify with some ground truth when a lie took place. So, for example, we know that there were deceptions with Clinton when he was talking about Monica Lewinsky. Those have been historically sort of verified. Nixon. There's all of these presidential lies that are very well recorded and things of that. So we're starting to look at those, but we did a more recent one on the Bush administration's rationale into going to war with Iraq. And I'll just pull up one quick slide here. This is a bunch of journalists in DC tracked every statement that the Bush administration made about Iraq from 9/11 to a few months after when the war began. The war begins here, okay, in April 2003. And they track two historically now, I would say, verified false statements. Weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq possessed them, and that Iraq possessed active links to Al-Qaeda. Okay? And the 9/11 Commission has stated pretty conclusively that neither of those were the case. All right, so here are false statements, and it's not clear that these are deceptions. Their administration has argued that they were misled, and so that would make this a mistake according to our definition of deception. Although some within the administration have said that these were deceptions, so Scott McClellan released a book that indicated that some of these were deceptive. And so what we do is we can take a look at all of these messages which were identified as deceptive, as false, and we put them in one bag of words, if we will. And we can take all of the messages that surrounded those into another bag of words. So here's what their database looked like. You probably can't read it there, but this is a Dick Cheney on February 15th, 2002. Iraq is clearly, again, as the President pointed out in the State of the Union speech, very much of concern. So not anything false stated there. But in the next sentence, they highlighted as yellow because the journalist coded it as false. Not only do they have a robust set of programs to develop their own weapons of mass destruction, this is a place that has used it. Okay, so we took what was in yellow and we put it over here. And we took the words around it, sentences that surrounded it, which didn't have any false statements, and we put them over here. And then what we can do is we can analyze them using the linguistic tools that I mentioned earlier, that I study language of deception as well. And we can... Do you guys want this? Okay, all right. And we can look at some of the features of the discourse in terms of frequency that are related to deception or not. We look at quite a few different patterns, but these three are very sort of common and been shown in a number of different dimensions, from our online dating studies to in the lab to prisoners, you know, doing lies. A lot of different ways that these have been studied. It's basically called the Newman-Pennebaker model. When people are lying, they tend to produce fewer first-person singular, so I and me, than when they're telling the truth. Negative emotion words tend to increase when people are lying. It's a leakage cue, so that when people lie, they tend to feel uncomfortable, and this is assumed to leak out in their nonverbal behaviors primarily. This is Paul Ekman's major contribution, but also seems to be the case with language as well. Last are exclusives. This is a category of words like except, however, and but. That is a real simple superficial indicator of the complexity of discourse. The more of these things, the more complex the discourse. Lies tend to be less complex than truthful statements. So we can analyze the false and non-false statements and see if the pattern fits with this sort of model of deception on these three dimensions. So if they were lying, then these should go down. If they were mistakes, then it's difficult to think why a mistake would see a change in these patterns. If it's mistaken, I still hold the belief that these things are true, which is certainly the case here in the non-false statement. So one could argue they should stay the same, and if they're being deceptive, they should differ. And what we find is indeed that the first-person singular, when talking about weapons of mass destruction and links to Al-Qaeda, I went down. We see the same thing with the leakage cue. So when the top administrators, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, etc., there were eight of them, when they were talking about these false statements, their negative emotion things went up. And this might be related to the fact that, you know, this was about sort of establishing the frightening situation that weapons of mass destruction would indicate. And then the other one was about lower complexity, and we should see that decrease, and in fact we did. When false statements were made, there was fewer of these complexity discourse indicators in the text. And there's a number of other dimensions that it differed on. I just wanted to focus on those three. So that's a long way of answering that. Actually, these are kind of lies that are the most fascinating from a language point of view. These lightweight lies, and they're lightweight in the sense that no one's going to die, right? They're still really important, I think. The language is much less evocative of these big changes, because this is, you know, is there any greater motivation for a deception than to take a nation to war? And again, we don't know whether this was deception or not. The pattern's consistent with it. History will ultimately tell us whether there was deception or not. But yes, yeah, so we are looking for more of these sorts of big lies. If anybody has any thoughts, we're looking at insurance fraud now. We're looking at corporate fraud. So CEOs now quarterly have to say what their company's state is, and we can tie that with future earnings reports. And some people have already started doing that. Yes, exactly right. So, yeah. Yeah.
Is there any study how accurate online product or service reviews are?
Yeah, we just started doing that. We're looking at TripAdvisor reviews for hotels. And it actually came from a blog post that Louis Van Aan from CMU did, which was he started to think that reviews that had by reviewers with only one review posted were likely to be deceptive. Because, you know, if there's a review and that person's only ever given one review, they tend to be really, really positive or really, really negative. And so what we're doing is looking now at creating fake reviews, getting students to do it, getting Amazon Turkers to create these fake reviews, and then comparing them to what we think are real ones. And a group in Texas just did a brief little study of that using 40 fake reviews and 40 non-fake, and you get some similarities to this pattern. So first person singular plays a role. So hopefully we'll be able to come up with a little program that can at least identify whether it's showing deceptive patterns or not, but that's ongoing.
Are you entering fake reviews into sites like Yelp?
No.
That seems like it has a
that would be ethically incorrect. Yeah. No, we're having people create them and then give them to us.
Okay.
And it's made very clear to them that we won't be putting them on there. And we're also analyzing the single review reviewers and comparing them to multi-review reviewers. And they are already starting to look different.
It would be interesting to keep digging down that hole and looking at sort of the network of relationships between, you know, how many reviewers you have on different sites and seeing how that relates to.
Yeah.
So how do you determine whether something is false? I mean, you know, a lot of what's on a place like Yelp is just, you know, somebody's personal experience and their opinion. How do you tell them, how do you say that that's a lie?
Right, we can't. That's why we're having people create fake ones.
Yeah, okay.
But we can make a good guess, we think, with a single review reviewer.
Even if somebody has a grudge, well, that grudge might be based on something real.
That's right. Absolutely. No, absolutely. We don't have any ground truth on those. And, you know, at some point, everybody will only have one review. Right?
I think there is some, like, theory that says that, you know, people have a very strong feeling from experience, and they have a terrible experience at a hotel, then they get motivated to go, you know, have the retribution and post something. But otherwise, you know, every other hotel is kind of middling, so they don't measure that. I mean, my wife has posted one thing on TripAdvisor, and it was a bad review of a hotel we stayed at. Mm-hmm. That's the only time.
The only time. Yeah. She was, like, motivated to do that.
Well, I used to edit a magazine, and one of the things that there are people who keep track of positive versus negative letters to the editor across several publications.
Uh-huh.
And essentially, the universal experience is somewhere around 5 negative to everyone that's positive.
Right, right.
And our magazine ran about 9-1. But
a little higher.
The ones that are...
No, those are the ones that are received. Yeah.
Yeah. So it also seems on TripAdvisor that a lot of the concern, or Yelp, with false reviews is that they're by the business.
Right.
So it's the positive ones that there might be multiple versions, and they come in, you know, and say, I was back, it was really great. So it's hard to...
More likely to see exceptions in positive reviews.
Right? Yeah, we're limiting ours to the positives
right
now.
And I believe there's a lawsuit right now involving Yelp that alleges that the people, the businesses who are actually buying advertising on the site were miraculously receiving positive reviews. Yes. And that's a big deal from a business point of view, obviously.
Oh, yeah. TripAdvisor, it has a massive influence. I think a property's income is very strongly correlated with how you look on TripAdvisor. Yeah. So I think this is just another thing. Like, Wikipedia's got around this by bringing the community to bear on it and establishing rules and things of how things are made. And I'm just waiting for...
It's also...
A lot of online reputation of individuals. But you also have the mitigating factor that if you get caught... doing aggressive censorship of negative information or lying on your own website, then it looks really bad for you. So this goes to the lie frequently and on. And
right,
and
right,
and
subtly, yeah.
But also Wikipedia is in a different space because, you know, that you can make a lot of rules. You can design something around something that's meant to be entirely about verifiable information.
Uh-huh.
Whereas, so there's, you know, the sense they can say this isn't referenced or this isn't a good reference. You can have a whole discussion. It's very clear that it's really meant to weed out things that are opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas TripAdvisor is meant to be all opinion.
About
at some
opinion.
Point, it's really hard to say, you know, did I really hate that meal or is the owner, you know, my ex-roommate and I hate him.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, and so I wonder if there will be, the experts are needed more when you're in an opinion space, whereas a wiki kind of community would be more important in a verifiable space, like in something where it's factually based?
But that's assuming that experts are always completely truthful. I think some of it is also an issue of scale, too. It's one thing if you can persuade one or two people to write something or there's one vengeful review, but if I look at a hotel on TripAdvisor has 300 reviews.
Mm-hmm.
The outliers are outliers. Mm-hmm. Some of it may be scaled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. Yes?
Positive reviews, then you're ignoring or discounting the possibility that a business is covertly trashing its competitor.
Yes, we will have to ignore those for now.
I don't know how common that kind of deception is compared to the deception of sort of, you know, covertly self-promoting, but...
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that is that, for instance, while Yelp has its problems that it has done that some of the other sites don't do as well, is to try and create something a little bit like the social network of community, which is that people want to stand out there as reviewers who have reputations. So I think some of it is the more you can get people to focus on your reputation as a reviewer, you know that you have more at stake when they go to that restaurant and there's some ground truth. They're like, I'm not going to follow this person's advice anymore because I don't agree with them.
Right.
So I think that's one of the biggest
pieces
is the individual identity.
Which
TripAdvisor doesn't really do.
Yeah, it just shows you how many reviews that they've done. That's your only
label. The effect of reviewers reviewing other reviewers.
Right.
Like,
eBay.
He wrote an unfair review.
Right, but it's like if I go to a hotel and I could just say, I love this hotel, and I want some way of marking all the people who also said they loved it, because I can say, these are a set of people whose opinions we share. Mm-hmm. You know, some of it might be just honest differences of opinion. I think this is cool and modern, and someone else thinks it's stark and boring, you know. So it just, it's a part of it is about creating a community of people who both are honest enough that there is some ground truth to what they're saying and similar to you. But anyway, so thank you.
Yeah, awesome. And thank you guys. We appreciate it.